I'm Douglas Northup, director of the Center for Russian and East European Studies, as most of you know. I, as is customary, want to begin by announcing upcoming events to make sure they're on your calendar. I'm going to announce one that is set for March 12th. This is longer into the future than is customary. That's because Roberta pointed out I should remind everyone, I'm sure everyone's forgotten, that next week is the break. Really? Yeah, that's right, that's right. Yeah. So we would be glad to have you come next Monday, but we will not be here. So that's your choice. So the event I wanted to call your attention to is a joint panel on Afghanistan on March 12th at 4 o'clock. We have a collection of anthropologists coming to speak about contemporary Afghanistan and American action therein. And I wanted to mention that today, given the newspaper stories about the commitment having been made to send tens of thousands of American troops into Afghanistan. So just put that on your calendars now. That will be visited by David Edwards, Alessandra Mansouti, and Nazif Shahrani. It's a remarkable lineup. Today, we are joined by Heather Dehan, soon to be wearing this microphone. Heather comes to us most immediately from the Kennan Institute, where she's spending this semester. This semester as a research fellow, and she also comes from the State University of New York at Binghamton, where she is an assistant professor of history. This is a noteworthy position. I will point out, for those of you aware of field questions, it's the same spot that incubated many other prominent historians of Russia, Lynn Viola, Francine Hirsch. I'm not sure how far back I want to go in the litany. Those are two that I know personally who have come out of this spot. So they have an excellent track record in picking people. And we all, I think, see the same promise in their current occupant for the field of Soviet history. This is a rising star lecture, in other words, is what I'm trying to say. This, I think, is an accolade that Heather has earned through creative and interdisciplinary work, which, to my mind, is both imaginative and rigorous, which is an unusual combination, and it's one that is to be applauded. She focuses especially, if I might generalize, on questions of space, above all. Space, place, landscape, environment, and the complicated sets of interactions those ideas produce between social communities, personal and collective identities, politics, and architecture. Obviously, these are very small and easily answered questions, so she has a very straightforward task with us today. Her dissertation, which she completed in 2005 at the University of Toronto, where she worked with that same Lynn Viola, offered a close study of the rebuilding of Nizhny Novgorod in the 1930s, which was on its way to becoming a new place under a new name. This is Gorky, the name many of you may have known. That dissertation won a prestigious prize from the AAISS. That is the Tucker Cohen Prize, awarded annually to the best PhD dissertation in political science and political history of the Soviet Union. She's written and published articles coming out of that work about modernists and modernization and backwardness and the layerings of different kinds of spaces and so on, about the power of landscape in all kinds of ways. And that's related to the framing from which the talk today will come. Her lecture today is called The Building of Stalin-Era Nizhny Novgorod, Gorky, Matter, Metaphor, and Power. Please join me in welcoming Heather Dehan. Okay.
See, is that okay? Not too close? Good. Okay, well, thank you very much for the invitation. It's a pleasure and a privilege, and it gives me the opportunity to invite you to grapple with me on a question that I've grappled with for 3 years now. And it's actually tied to that dissertation that Doug mentioned, which was, at the time of defense, effectively two books that I'm trying to turn into one manuscript. Or maybe it wasn't two books. When I went into my defense, every single member of my committee said, you're ready for defense, but you have two books here. By the time I got to defense, they said it's one book, but none of them agreed what the book was about. And so the real challenge I've had is trying to tie this together. Now, to get at why this divided into two books, and the challenge that I want to explore with you today, I put this poster up, right? It's a poster, a Soviet poster from 1952. You obviously recognize Stalin. You can obviously see the Moscow Tall building. It's Moscow in the background. And it says there, "Praise to the great Stalin, the architect of communism." And we wouldn't call Stalin an architect, would we? It's too positive. We call him things like thug, dictator, conniver, murderer, things like that. But architect is the choice that he made. And in fact, many dictators choose to be architects because it embodies that sort of Nietzschean desire to recreate the world through ideas and through space. You know, you recreate those ideas through space and space through ideas. And in that sense, architecture, which is where this conceptual realm meets the concrete, is this sort of ideal space for realizing this creative ambition. And where I'm going with this is this whole problem of conceptual space, this realm of ideas, and concrete, material, physical space as they interact in the realm of architecture. In my title, I basically played with the same idea. I like alliteration, matter and metaphor, concrete and conceptual. And the whole question I have here is the way in which the space of ideas relates to physical space. Now, one of the ways I dealt with this when looking at urban planning was the concept of translation. I borrowed an idea taken from Walter Benjamin, linguistic translation, where he talks about the way in which when you translate a piece of work from one language to another, you open up new spaces in both languages. Because there are certain terms that don't translate exactly. So to bring that into the new language, you have to open up a new concept there. And in the process of doing that, you can reshape what that term meant in the original language. And you can see this occurring also in city planning, where you have an abstract ideal that has to be realized through physical spaces and necessarily adapts to those spaces. And is it changed? So both the space and the ideal change. There are new spaces opened up in both. Now, to get at this, I'm going to take you through the space that these architects in Nizhny Novgorod worked in and lived in. Because what I'm not just talking about is, you know, these two books, conceptual and concrete. The reason why it became two books is because architects are operating on these two levels. And one of the ways you see this interacting is in the soterioscape that's embedded in Nizhny Novgorod, already in the 17th century and is reinvented by Soviet authorities in the 20th. So let me introduce you to the space in which architects work. First of all, on this map, let's see if I can get this to point for me. Oh, there we go. You see, on the left, you can see the Oka River, the blue flowing into the Volga, and Nizhny Novgorod is there. That's 500 kilometers northeast of Moscow, okay? So people in Nizhny Novgorod identify the location of their city this way. They say Petersburg is the head, Moscow is the heart, and Nizhny Novgorod is this little pocket where you put your money. Because it's at the juncture of these two rivers. It's a commercial juncture. And that's why the city was founded in 1221, okay? And it's founded on a promontory overlooking those two rivers. So I can't get the pointer to work here. I'll have to go without. If you look here on the right, I'll just do it this way. This is an elevated area. That's the old ancient Nizhny Novgorod from 1221. And it looks down over the city. And if you go to the founding period, this is from 1938. If you go to when it was founded, there was nothing on the left side of the Oka River. It's marshland. And it floods, okay? So the area in which that I'm talking about is right here. That's historic Nizhny Novgorod. To look at it closer, it expands to the other bank in 1817, and then you can see on the left bank a trade fair. But the part I'm looking at right now is the part that's circled. And to get a sense of that physical space, here's a picture. If you're standing on the Oka River looking up at the Kremlin, and the Kremlin is just, it's a walled city. All these Russian cities have Kremlins. You actually find yourself looking up at that space. You have a sense of how that's laid out. Now here you see the Kremlin at the other side. In the far back, that's not the Oka River, but the Volga River. There's a steep incline there. You can't see it on the picture. And then you can see here the Kremlin wall coming through. Now this area is flat, it's all elevated. So for protection on this side, they relied on a moat. So this whole highway is what is now a filled-in moat, okay? Anyways, that's the space that we're dealing with. So the 17th century, and in this particular space, what happened is a soterioscape, as I would say, it becomes etched in it. And it is etched in it not by any single plan. It comes by different individuals building different buildings at different times in different places. And a soterioscape is basically, it's a merger of the words soteriology and landscape. Okay, soteriology is this narrative of redemption. And your landscape is, of course, your cityscape, the physical space. And you'll find as you move through this city from west to east, you are figuratively moving through this story of redemption, the soterioscape. And I'll talk you through it first and then show you some images. Okay? You start right here at the base on the Oka River. That's where you find Annunciation Monastery. And if you know your New Testament story, you know that the Annunciation would be that moment when the Archangel Gabriel comes to Mary and she says, you're going to give birth to the Messiah. Okay? So that's the beginning of this promise of salvation history. That's where the soteriology begins, that God will step into human history to transform it. Okay? Then you walk along this road that comes up, and about halfway down, you come to Nativity Church. So you've gone from Annunciation to Nativity Church, which, of course, is the Incarnation. That's the moment when God becomes man, is born, enters human history, binds the divine will to the human will. When you come to this sort of white round patch, that's the Kremlin. To get into that, you have to go through something called John the Baptist Gates. Once again, if you know your New Testament history, when Christ is baptized by John, that's the beginning of his ministry on earth. So figuratively, as you walk from the exterior of the Kremlin to the interior, you are entering, in a metaphorical sense, the world of Christ's ministry on earth. Okay? Then the Kremlin is built into a hill. So you have to go up, a very, very high hill. And at the top of this, it's like a Via Dolorosa, but you don't come to a cross at the top. You come to the Cathedral of the Transfiguration. And for the Orthodox, this is as important, maybe even more important than the cross in Christian theology. That's that moment where Christ's divinity shines through his humanity. And that's a promise. That's a promise that embodies the promise that they believe is in the Incarnation. Well, what happens is the divine will takes this human will and redirects it, pulls it towards God, and with that enacts both human and cosmic redemption. There's more there. Then after that, you're almost out of the Kremlin. It's a few steps, you go out the other gate, and you come to the chapel, the Exaltation of the Cross. The ministry is over, Christ is crucified, that story is over, and then from there you go down the hill to the Volga River, and you find another monastery, the Monastery of the Caves, or the Catacombs, which is the church, okay? Now, what's interesting about this space, as I said, is that it's not a planned space. The monasteries emerge in the 13th century. The Cathedral of the Transfiguration is there in the 13th century and rebuilt multiple times. Nativity Church emerges in the 17th century, as does the Chapel of the Exaltation of the Cross. All different time periods. There's no single person putting this together. But when you find the Soviet authorities go in, what's interesting is they flip this all and they create their own soteriology. And again, there's no single plan behind it. I looked through the documents for the 20th century. You can't find it there. It's as if they're responding to the space and sort of unconsciously producing their own soteriology, which can only really be articulated this way because of what is already there. Okay, so I'll show you this. Annunciation Monastery. It sits there on the Oka River. There you can sort of see how it's positioned. It's sort of spread out here, right? It's all the way from this round church on the left to the steeples you find on the right. Now, what Soviet authorities do with that is they put a planetarium there. So rather than the Annunciation of, you know, the Incarnation of Christ, you have the Big Bang, the beginning of the universe, right? Nativity Church, they leave the building intact on the exterior. On the interior, they put a Museum of Municipal Development. So no longer is the Incarnation the hope, but rather trams, you know, electricity, sanitation systems. This is the new source of salvation. Now, you still have to go into John the Baptist Gate, which Soviet authorities simply let fall into decay. And then you go up that hill, up, where you would have come to the Cathedral of the Transfiguration. But Soviet authorities tear that down entirely and put there a House of Soviets. So the new salvation is no longer uniting divine will to human will, but rather working class brotherhood and unity. There's the new message at the core. When you come out of the East Kremlin gates, you're supposed to come to the Chapel of the Exaltation of the Cross. Here's where you get what I would call discursive confusion. This chapel disappears already less than 100 years after it's put up. Peter the Great has the gall to put on that spot Annunciation Cathedral. Peter the Great is obviously not from the city, doesn't understand where things belong in this soteriocape, and sticks something in the wrong spot. Soviet authorities tear down that cathedral. You can see there's none there in this Soviet-era picture. And instead, they put monuments to patriotic heroes or heroes of achievement. So they have Minin on the right, and then at the very top of this whole ensemble, you see a man on a monument. That's the Chkalov monument. So there's another Soviet hero. And they planned maybe to put the Gorky monument here. So this is what they do with that particular space. Now Pechorsky Monastery. You can see here that you're looking down at it. You would walk down towards it. Here's a contemporary picture of it. In that space, what they put is waterfront green space, a sports zone. So, you know, your sort of new heaven is not the church, rather it's relaxation and rest, that sort of thing. Now, this whole soteriology that Soviet authorities articulate, number one, they don't seem to know they're doing it. When I gave this talk, I discovered this by walking through the city. I actually would walk this in reverse every day on my way from the place that I lived on my way to the library. And I start to look around and I think, wow, this is amazing. And I told people about that and they said, no, it can't be. I mean, these things are all changed at different times. We never heard about this. And some people accepted it and said, wow. Other people said, well, it's just a coincidence. No matter which way you put it, though, it's a coincidence that can only be articulated in this way because of what already was. And it gives new meaning both in some ways to that old landscape and to the new Soviet one, right? Now, to get at the two books problem that I had, I want to go to a tension in that Soviet landscape, okay? That's not necessarily there in the earlier 17th century one. And that is where you have sort of a dual message of how things are going to be fixed. There's a Nativity Church, which becomes a museum of municipal development. That's all about science, technology, functional, rational planning, and that sort of stuff. But then they also have the House of Soviets. That's at the pinnacle. Well, that's about working class brotherhood. That's about a new unity. That doesn't necessarily have to do with science. In fact, you find those two forces clashing in the Cultural Revolution from 1928 to 1931. That's a time period where you find the absolute height of avant-garde, rational, technical, functionalist planning. You also find these very vociferous working-class movements to have workers as writers, as architects, as engineers, and that can even be counterproductive for excellent scientific production. Now, architects have to function within both of those, and you find that from 1931 to 1935, they tend to function within the story of Nativity Church, functionalist, rationalist. And then from 35 to World War II, they shift, and their focus in producing socialism seems to be very much about producing this imagined community, this working class brotherhood, okay? So I'm gonna take you through those two books. The first one, when I had it, it was a part of this book. I called it Seeing Like a State, okay? And that's really the way to think of it. It was a play on James Scott's book by the same title, where he has that, it's an excellent book, right, about the high modern state and its vision and how it tends to impose a rationalistic vision on a reality. And, of course, it's destructive and the force never works. Now, it's true, but what happened in Russia as they were trying to create socialism is that they had an ideal at the top, an absolute ideal for what socialism should be. And it wasn't just industry, it was education, it's public health, right? It's all of these different things that we would, you know, ourselves also associate with human well-being, with what we want in terms of development, okay? But then to have these implemented, they would deliver particular programs to institutions. So they say to the Ministry of Public Health, you're responsible for developing sanitation systems. The Ministry of Transportation, you develop a transportation plan, right? Heavy industry leaders, you